The next case of the morning is number 05-3835, David Julian against Randolph. Mr. Gotti.
There's one undisputed, uncontrovertible fact in this case. Mr. Julian's counsel, Mr. Sheehan, admitted on cross-examination that based on his reading of the Apprendi case, that he told Mr. Julian, quote-unquote, that he couldn't get anything more than 30 years. Mr. Julian then, as a result, he had reached a negotiated plea for 23 years and actually attended an August 15th, 2000 hearing, at which time they were about to accept the plea. But as a result of this advice, he decided to reject the plea, and he was ultimately sentenced to 40 years. Unfortunately for Mr. Julian, Mr. Sheehan's advice is directly contrary to the Apprendi case. This court, so with regard to the first prong of Strickland, this court held in Moore that a lawyer has to give a good faith analysis of the law. And what Mr. Sheehan said when he was talking about Apprendi, he said, the reason why you're limited to 30 is that a prior conviction was not listed in your indictments, and therefore it can't serve as a sentence enhancer. But we know that Apprendi, Justice Stevens, explicitly says that Apprendi was carving out an exception for a previous Supreme Court case, Almendarez-Torres, which held that a prior conviction does not need to be listed in an indictment to serve as a sentence enhancer.
Is there anything in the record about whether Mr. Sheehan read Almendarez-Torres before he advised Mr. Julian?
Yeah, he testified that based on his reading of Apprendi, that's what he said, based on my reading of Apprendi, I told him that he couldn't get anything more than 30 years.
So he had read Almendarez-Torres?
That's what he testified to, yes. But I think the Moore case, the idea that you have to give a good faith analysis of the applicable law, I think means more than just picking up a case. You have to give some thought to its holding and its applicability. And Apprendi is so clear regarding what it is saying and what it is not. Justice Stevens takes the reader by the hand and says, this is what we're not doing. And he says, we're carving out an exception for Almendarez-Torres. And then on top of that, he also says that we are not even dealing with the indictment and prior conviction issue. So I think it's absolutely clear with just even one reading of Apprendi that case didn't even apply to the issue here, which was whether or not the prior conviction could serve as a sentence enhancer. With regard to, I think the state has raised the idea of this proof of a lack of good faith. Where this court has discussed that in some of its cases, it seems to be concerned that there are factors other than a lack of good faith that would explain the mistake. For example, in the Barnes case, the lawyer missed the fact that there was a parole revocation that then qualified his client as a career offender. And the court said, well, maybe it was a lack of good faith, but maybe it was something different. Maybe it was because he didn't have time. I guess there was evidence that he may have not had time to discover that fact. Or maybe it wasn't readily apparent, the effect of that parole revocation. But here we don't have that. Mr. Sheehan had the answer in his hand. He says he read Justice Stevens's language. And again, that language, I think, is absolutely clear. There's no other reasonable interpretation but to come to the conclusion that it was not overruling Almendarez. And so we've shown that it was due to a lack of good faith as opposed to some other factor.
Well, good faith language in Moore against Bryant, does that introduce some kind of a subjective inquiry into this analysis? I mean, does it let the lawyer off the hook if he's, you know, got a warm heart but an empty head?
Right. I think it's saying that you need more than a warm, you need more than a warm body. You need more. You need to do more than just pick up the case.
But can you just try hard and get off the hook?
Some of the cases seem to see. I don't think that's this case. I don't think picking up a case is just enough. You have to give a minimal amount of thought to its holiness and applicability. And I think when you have a situation...
Why didn't we say in Bryant that it has to be a reading mm-hmm. which a reasonably well-educated and experienced member of the bar would give to the Supreme Court precedent? Wouldn't that... I mean, it's an objective matter. Would this have been the kind of reading of that case that... other members of the bar would consider to be a reasonable one under all the circumstances.
I guess under the analysis, under the Moore standard, you do have to ask in the particular case.
I don't see how you can reconcile Moore with Strickland. That's my problem. There seems to be a tension there. Moore, it seems to introduce subjectivity that is not present in Strickland.
So you have an issue with the Moore case versus Strickland. Okay. I guess we can back up to Strickland. Strickland says that you're entitled to effective assistance of counsel. And plea negotiations are one of the most important parts of the criminal proceedings. And if a plea is offered, then that is triggered. You have to have effective assistance. And what the right that Mr. Julian had was the right to make a fully informed decision regarding that 23-year offer. And part of that, so he's taking all the information that's coming from his lawyer. And so I think Strickland does say that, as the lawyer is giving that information, it has to have been done in good faith. It just can't be a lawyer can't just willy-nilly just start giving opinions knowing maybe that he didn't read the statute, for example, and more, et cetera.
Yeah, we might note, I suppose, that in Moore, the defendant didn't have to contend with the type of conflicting evidence that we have in this case, because Moore's counsel acknowledged that he didn't have the statute with him when he provided the advice, and he also acknowledged that he was uncertain as to its effect.
And that's true, but I think what we have in this case is Justice Stevens on the page saying, I'm not overruling Almendarez-Torres. It can't be any more explicit. So if there are cases out there that are more difficult to decide, I don't think that is this is one of them. He admitted to reading that language. It says we're carving out a specific exception, and oh, by the way, I'm not even going to address the prior conviction indictment issue. I just think it's so clear here that there's no reasonable interpretation of Apprendi, except to realize that Almendarez was still good law, that this court should be able to find that it was deficient performance. I see I'm into my rebuttal time, unless you have any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Guy. We'll hear now from Ms. Myers.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Leah Myers from the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of the respondent, the warden, in this case. This court granted a certificate of appealability to address a single issue in a Section 2254 habeas case, whether petitioner's trial counsel was ineffective for providing erroneous advice as to the length of sentence he faced after conviction, and whether the state court reasonably applied Strickland regarding this claim. Now, before we even get to the details of applying the Strickland two-prong test, there is a threshold matter that this court must first address. And that is the fact that, as this court can see in the chart at pages 16 and 17 of respondent's brief, that at every stage of state court post-conviction proceedings, before the federal district court, and in the petition for certificate of appealability, Petitioner always and only described the factual basis for his ineffective assistance claim to be that counsel guaranteed a maximum 30-year sentence. The state trial court held an evidentiary hearing on this matter, hearing testimony by petitioner and counsel, and afterwards denied post-conviction relief by making a specific factual finding that while counsel may have predicted a 30-year sentence, which turned out to not be the case, he never guaranteed a maximum.
Well, yeah, but look, would you concede that in your best case scenario, the very best case, that is, if Mr. Sheehan was merely opining, you know, giving his opinion as to what an appropriate sentence might be, and he wasn't offering any guarantees, that he was still wrong about Apprendi? In other words, given Apprendi's holding, 30 years was not an appropriate sentence for Julian, either pre-Apprendi or post-Apprendi.
If I understand your question correctly, Your Honor, the state would concede that when looking at the allegation that counsel said that due to the fact the prior conviction was not in the indictment, that it could not be used as a sentence-enhancing factor, we concede that is erroneous under Apprendi. However, the evaluation of this advice must be made at the time that it was given, which is August 15, 2000, a mere 6 weeks after Apprendi was released, when there was no case law in any Illinois reviewing court and no case law from this court interpreting Apprendi. There was widespread confusion in the wake of Apprendi.
But given the language, could any reasonable lawyer believe that Almendarez Torres had been overruled?
Yes, Your Honor, and that is for two reasons. The first is that in the Apprendi majority itself, the majority stated that there is it is arguable whether Almendarez Torres has any continued viability. And the second point is that Justice Thomas, in his concurrence, stated he's changed his mind. And in Almendarez Torres, he was a member of the five-person majority. And by making this new position clear, there were now five votes for the very position that counsel allegedly said to his petitioner. And because there was no interpreting case law at that time, all he had to look at is, look, now there's five Supreme Court judges that have this opinion that the enhancing factor must be in the indictment, well, and that could be the basis for his advice.
My view of the Apprendi majority would be that the Apprendi majority specifically stated that it would not revisit Almendarez Torres and instead would treat the case as a narrow exception to the general rule we recalled at the outset. So I'm going to have to try and reconcile your view with mine.
Well, that is true, Your Honor, but the state can also point to Justice O'Connor's dissent, where she disagrees with the majority specifically because it is inconsistent with Almendarez Torres. And this is another statement he could have looked at within the 100-page opinion to say, wait a minute, maybe they're not expressly doing it yet, but the writing's on the wall. It is coming down the pike whenever the issue is directly presented to the court.
That only gets us, you know, a half step, doesn't it? Because then this question still is, would a reasonable lawyer, you know, reading, you know, the tea leaves, counting the heads in separate opinions and everything, still give the advice to a client in a criminal case that that tea leaf reading puts a cap on what you could possibly get in the way of a sentence?
Sure, and 2 points. First of all, respondent would like to agree with Your Honor's question to opposing counsel that this is best looked at as an objective test here for deficient performance. And in applying this objective test, this court should look to other case law that has been addressing this prong, such as Barnes and Cieslowski. And in the Barnes case, the counsel failed to discover a prior conviction that made him eligible as a career offender. And in Cieslowski, counsel failed to discover an amendment to the relevant sentencing provision. And these very basic, very obvious omissions by counsel were not found to be deficient performance. And the reason this court gave, in part, is because where a record is silent about what actions counsel took, that the presumption is of reasonableness, which is very consistent with the Strickland case. And that is why, in contrast to Barnes and Cieslowski, here He read the 100-page decision. That was the only evidence in the record about what he did, and that is exactly the opinion he should have reviewed. And yes, it was 100 pages. It had five separate opinions. There was language that identified that perhaps there's no arguable viability of Almendarez-Torres, although there was also language that the issue wasn't being directly addressed. There was Justice Thomas's change of his opinion in his concurrence, and that is why, compared to Barnes and Cieslowski, this is not as egregious an omission by counsel.
I may invite your attention to the second prong of the Strickland test. Page 32 of your brief, you make an argument that even if we accept the petitioner's view of the first prong, that still he has not shown prejudice. And I must say I've reread this several times now, and I appreciate your verbally perhaps giving me your view as to why you have a case on prejudice.
The most important fact that shows why there is no prejudice here is that we have, and this is unusual, we have petitioner's own description of the events that took place, and that is specifically a letter that he wrote to the trial counsel describing what occurred, and this court can look at page 46 of the separate appendix if you want to see the exact quote. But what petitioner specifically said was, and I'll quote it, is that I want it stipulated on the record that a negotiated plea had been reached in the beginning of 23 years, but due to Mr. Mara, that's the prosecutor, adding to it without my knowledge, I backed out, which upset Mr. Mara, and he refused to give me the original offer. Now, what petitioner is talking about here is the fact that when the hearing was occurring, the prosecutor spoke up and said, by the way, I just want to note that because he was on mandatory supervised release or parole at the time, that his new conviction could be used to violate him from MSR and that he would then have to serve consecutively this MSR term in prison potentially. That is what petitioner himself identified contemporaneously as the fact that caused him to back out of the plea offer. Now, there we could talk about the sentence differentials, we could talk about other facts, but that's only circumstantial evidence about what was happening in petitioner's mind. Here we have his own words that he submitted to the trial court where he describes as this additional consecutive sentence as being the reason why he rejected the plea offer, which is completely separate from any advice that counsel may have given him. But one quick point, too. Before, again, this court has to even delve into deficient performance or prejudice, there is first the threshold matter of what is preserved here. And that is that, again, the factual basis of a guaranteed maximum sentence was all that was alleged in state court. And that, in the district court rejected habeas relief here because it said that petitioner did not provide clear and convincing evidence to rebut the factual finding that counsel never guaranteed a maximum sentence. And clearly, under Strickland, if there's a factual finding that counsel never took the action that is the alleged ineffectiveness, then surely there is no ineffective assistance of counsel. Now, here in the brief before this court, petitioner tries to change to shift his claim by alleging a new factual basis of an erroneously predicted sentence. However, this is a new factual basis that was never presented to the state courts and not to the district court, and so is forfeited. So
why wouldn't whether the ill advice came from a guarantee or speculation, why wouldn't that be merely a refinement of his existing argument? I'm not understanding why he has to preserve each minute subpart. Certainly there's room for refinement of the argument, provided that, you know, he has preserved the general claim of effective assistance. It's not a separate claim. And furthermore, he refined the argument in response to this court's order to address Strickland. So I wanted to just ask you this. Do you think it's ever possible for a defendant to prove the absence of good faith effort without an attorney admitting error?
I see my time has expired, if I may have leave
I'd
to answer your question.
Your answer.
Sure. Well, first, let me very briefly address the first point, that there are two separate factual bases here, and that is because if you put yourself in the position of petitioner and you hear either there's a guaranteed maximum 30-year sentence or, you know, my opinion is you might get 30, although you could get up to 60, that those involve very different calculuses in terms of whether or not a plea opinion will be accepted or rejected. But then addressing your second point, it's true that the attorney's testimony is the key because you're trying to find out what was done. That is true. And then applying that to this case, all we know is that, yes, counsel testified that he reviewed the relevant opinion, and that is why even if this court gets to the two Strickland prongs, neither prong can be established, and that is why this court should affirm the district court.
Yeah, but I'm trying to get an answer to something, and that is this. Is it ever possible, for a defendant to prove the absence of good faith effort without having the attorney admit error?
Off the top of my head, I could think of one possibility, and that is that perhaps if looking at the advice, and the advice is so off base and so inconsistent with whatever it is that should have been reviewed, that there is an inference there to be made. But in this case, because of the conflicting statements in Apprendi, this is not one of those cases. And I'm sorry, that's all I can think of.
If we don't think there are conflicting opinions in Apprendi, and if we think that Apprendi is as clear as, you know, the lake on a good day, your argument fails?
No, for two reasons, and that is because there also then must be prejudice, and there also must be the threshold finding that this is a preserved factual basis. But also, I would remind the court that we have to look at August 15th, 2000, and that there was widespread confusion in the wake of Apprendi, and not look at it as if it's October 19th, 2006. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. How much time does Mr. Gotting? He has 2 minutes left, since so he gave the government a little extra time. You've got four.
Well, thank you. First, with regard to the letter, it's true that Mr. Julian was apparently upset with the prosecutor in his comments about the parole evidence or the parole violation. But the letter, if you read a couple of paragraphs down, also again mentions that he was advised that the maximum sentence was 30 years. In other words, we can't view the first paragraph of the letter or his mindset in a vacuum. It has to be viewed in context. And we know at the same time the prosecutor was making his comments, he had also just been advised that you couldn't get anything more than 30 years. So taking all that together, it's reasonable to read that as, I guess the question is this: what allowed him to act on the fact that he was upset? And what allowed him to act on that was the advice regarding Apprendi. And so it's reasonable for him to say, okay, now I'm upset. What can I do? I've just been told that my max is 30. I'm going to reject the plea. And under Strickland, we only have to show that there was a reasonable probability that that advice played a role. I think this court in some cases has put it the opposite, or another way, that we only have to show that it had more than a negligible impact. So even if the prosecutor's comments did play a role, so did Mr. Sheehan's advice. That's what allowed him to make the decision that he did. So that's with regard to the letter. The second, with regard to the subjective versus objective, counsel for the state, I think, conceded that if someone is so wrong regarding their interpretation of the law when they have it in front of them, that can amount to being objectively unreasonable. And I think that's what we have in this case. The final point, which is with regard to this idea that we've changed our tune on appeal, that's absolutely not true. Mr. Julian has always said, listen, I was told in uncertain terms that I couldn't get anything more than 30. And I think that's the only reasonable interpretation of the phrase, you can't get anything more than 30. But if a court were to find that advice didn't amount to a guarantee, Mr. Julian still testified that he was told that the maximum was 30, can't get anything more than 30 years. And so under the Moore analysis, I still think a court has to say, okay, maybe it wasn't a guarantee, but still, was that advice unreasonable, the advice regarding the maximum sentence. And so the whole guarantee issue is only half the story. He also testified that he was told it was a maximum sentence.
May I ask your view on the submission of counsel for the government on page 32 of her brief with respect to the so-called prejudice prong? She seems to feel that even if we agree with you on the performance prong, that he still has simply not made out prejudice, because he seems to admit that there were other reasons for the plea.
As I just addressed with regard to the letter, the letter can't be viewed in a vacuum. He also was told that his max was 30 years, and so that was his mindset. He knew that if he wanted to act on the letter or act on the prosecutor's comments, that the Mr. Sheehan just handed him a reason to do it because he was maxed out at 30. More generally regarding prejudice, we have three reasons. One, he testified consistently that he would have accepted the plea but for the advice. Secondly, we have objective evidence that he walked into court, he had negotiated a plea. I see that my time is up. May I continue?
Please.
He had negotiated a 23-year plea offer, and as the state says in their own brief on direct appeal to the appellate court, he actually started to enter a negotiated plea for 23 years. It was only at the end did he then change his mind. So we have the objective evidence. And then, as Moore pointed out, this court also looks to the sentence differentials. Mr. Sheehan drastically reduced the perceived risk, Mr. Julian's perceived risk, from well over 30 years to down to 30. And in fact, the actual risk was just 7 years, the difference between 23 and 30. And those are the same factors that the Moore case combines to find prejudice. And we have that in our case.
I'm going to ask this one question. Mm-hmm. I don't want to drag this on, but as far as he was on probation, is that correct?
Yes, I believe he was on probation for a previous armed robbery.
Yeah, for previous armed robbery, and was obviously in a parole violation, and mm-hmm. he was going to be subjected to being put back in prison for parole violation. Is mm-hmm. there any discussion about the length of time he could have served for which this would have been consecutive?
I've looked in vain in the record, and I didn't see anything regarding how much time the parole violation would have been. And the reason is, and I'm not a criminal defense lawyer, but I think it's because the parole...
You are now.
You are now.
The parole board makes that decision, so I don't have that information.
Well, I'm just curious because that parole board could have made a decision based on this also. We got 40 years, therefore we're not going to put him back in prison for 10
right.
years.
I'll say that
and
I think...
I'm only saying that because there are other things that weigh into the balance of this and in his mind as well, I would think.
Right.
But anyway, we'll go with what we got.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel in the case and to Mr. Godding, especially because he was appointed in this case, and despite his protestations as a fine criminal defense lawyer. We do as well thank your law firm for having expended a significant amount of energy and resources on this matter. The case will be taken under advisement.